The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Chairing this session on Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution under siege. We have two fantastic speakers to get us started, and the first one is Jesus Rodriguez, who's the Consul General of Venezuela. We're very, very happy to have here in Chicago to present to us what is happening in Venezuela right now. Sure, we'll try to speak up. Thanks for letting me know. If anybody else, if you have any trouble hearing, just raise your hand in the back and we'll know that we've got to talk louder. Thanks.
Okay. Hi. My name is Jesus Rodriguez. I'm the Consul General of Venezuela in Chicago. I bring a slideshow that I want to show you, but it's not working. But anyway, what I'm planning to show you there are some facts about the most recent achievement, at least from the government perspective, that has reached the Venezuelan Revolution, the Bolivarian Revolution, and also I want to give you some information about the most progressive proposals that were contained in the referendum, in the constitutional reform referendum that happened already like almost 2 years ago. But I believe that in that proposal were a lot of progressive things that I want to talk with you. And also, I want to show you some the most recent information about nationalizations in Venezuela. So that's what is in the slideshow. Any of you that wants to, you want me to send you the slideshow, I will be more than happy to do it. I usually at the beginning apologize for my English, which is not the best, and I also encourage the audience to understand that even though I'm right now here, I'm a representative of the government of Venezuela, that doesn't mean that you have to be kind to me and not ask whatever you want to ask. I mean, we in Venezuela are more than open to discussions and to criticism, and we know that we are not perfect, but what we are trying to do is trying to do things, correct them while doing them, and trying to do what we consider is the best for the Venezuelan people. So, what I wanted to show you, I don't know if there is in the audience someone that can help, that might help me with this, because I believe, that knows a little bit about. I believe that everything is plugged, but maybe there's something between the signal, the video signal from here to there. Mm. So if you can help me with that.
F8.
Anyway, meanwhile, the title of the slideshow is Venezuela advancing towards socialism? That is the title of the presentation that I bring. And the first slide contains some information about, some fact sheet about Venezuela with a map with information about population. For example, the Venezuelan population right now is around 28 million people. Our area is almost 1 million square kilometers. It's like the area of Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico, something like that. And our GDP is, our unemployment rate is 7.3%. And that's very important for us because we, for the last, 15 years, have been having higher unemployment rates. Our GDP is almost $235,000 million for us 2007. Our international reserves are around $30 billion. Our inflation rate for last year was about 30%. That's one of the, in terms of economic, one of the biggest problems we have. I believe that we in Venezuela have the highest inflation rate in Latin America. And there are explanations for that. I believe that there are explanations in terms of the effect of the oil in our economy, but also in terms of the maybe the lack of action from the government also in some points. We were declared by the UNESCO a free literacy rate in 2004, and that's after a very important, aggressive social program that we call Mission Robinson. Our language, of course, is Spanish, and we also have a lot of indigenous languages. We are ranked in the 61st place among 179 countries in the Human Development Index, and we are proud of that because we have been going up in that index. Of course, we criticize somehow that index, I mean from the government, but somehow it reflects better than other indexes how a country grows economically and socially. And our debt service as a percentage of the GDP is 11%. That's very important because like 10 years ago, it was something around 33%. Almost a third of GDP went to the pay of the foreign debt. So here I have some achievements. We had a reduction in the public debt of 50%, for example. And we are proud of that. We also have a 24% increase in agro-production. That's important for us. We have the highest minimum wage in Latin America, that is around $324 a month. We have an unemployment reduction, as I told you, from 50%, which was like the average for the last 10 or 15 years, to 6.8%, which was our unemployment rate in December 2008. And this is very important, we'll increase in 400% the number of pensions. And also we equalize pensions to the minimum wage. And that might not sound very important for us, but for those who live in Venezuela in 1997, for example, they might know that we were ending a neoliberal government, and a lot of people in Venezuela didn't believe that they were going to receive pensions after they reached the terms that the law established. So right now, most of the people are certain that they are going to receive their pensions, and their pensions are equalized to the minimum wage each year. We have, at that point, like 200,000 people benefiting directly from pensions, and right now we have somewhere around 1,500,000 persons. And that's very important for us. We have a 30% reduction in infant mortality. We dedicate 4.2% of our GDP to health and 7% to education. And you don't see those figures around, but that's not something that you don't find usually in, at least in Latin American countries. You see a reduction of 13% in the gap between rich and poor. 6.5 million Venezuelans have now access to water. That means 92%. That went from 80% in 98 to 92% in 2007. I mean, the percentage of the population that have access to water. And right now we have 25, I don't know how to say that in English, among 1,000 students in university that we had in 98 versus 75 that we have now. So we tripled the number of people that are in higher education. So right now I'm going to the slide where I have the information, at least the constitutional reform in 2007 was very criticized and attacked by the media inside and outside Venezuela, and there were a lot of proposals that were not that were part of more of the internal Venezuelan political debate. So what I decided to take from that proposal were the most socialist and most progressive things, and I put it in a matrix that I wanted to show you. But somehow I'm going to try to read it to you. In economy terms, and we have there the Article 90 of that proposal, the Article 112 of that proposal, the Article 130, 150, 299, and 318. Those articles propose what goes next. The recognition of social-led productive units. I'm talking here about the constitutional recognition among the private the companies also recognizes, put in the same level also the social-led productive unit as co-ops, socialist enterprises, and all those projects that we are trying to promote in Venezuela, and they somehow equalize them. We, in those articles, strengthen the fights against the monopoly, especially when they attack social-led production units. We also, in that proposal, reserve to the state the control of the strategic activities and open its control to social-led production units. What this mean? In that proposal, in that constitution that was proposed in 2007, the state says that it has the right to take control of some strategic activities in the economy. And at some point, open it to the control-led productive units. Not only, I believe that that's important because somehow it reflects that the government or the state don't want to take control forever of those things and don't allow the communities to organize or the people that are the ones that really need to have in control of their production means to take control of that. The proposal also introduced the concept of public, social, and collective property. And that was important also because in the constitution that we have yet, because this proposal was not approved, I have to remind you of that. We submit this proposal to referendum, and we were defeated as a government in that referendum, but it was very tight. I mean, the results were very tight. I mean, it was something like 50% against and 99% in favor of the reform. So somehow we have the previous constitution. We those changes didn't pass. We also propose more control of the executive branch over the central bank, basically to allow the government to use international reserves to finance social programs and development programs. We also propose then the reduction of the work week from 44 hours to 36 hours. That proposal also contained the introduction of the concept of socialism, anti-imperialism, and humanism as socio-economic principles. So we don't have those things yet in our constitution, in our current constitution. We also introduced the concept of communes. I don't know if that's the word in English, but as the basic of the territory division of the country. And that was very important because the commune is the cell of the participatory democracy. So that was the contained in that proposal also. We also attacked some issues that are related to discrimination. For example, we introduce. There is something that was changed here. Hold on, give me a second. Basically, what was introduced is that we. Oh, that's great. Okay, what I'm gonna do is to go to the slideshow. Thank you.
There's some chairs on this side for people who can't see.
Yes, it's not easy, I know, but somehow. I don't know, it's fine that way. Thank you. Those who want to see some figures can please go to this side. So basically, the last three items there that are related to sexual discrimination. The recognition of the sexual discrimination was put into that proposal also. Also, the respect for the Afro-Venezuelan heritage and culture, and also the we equals the vote of students and workers in universities to the vote of the professors, and that is something very progressive, because you know, in Venezuela, for example, students have to collect like I don't remember, like 20 votes or 40 votes to equal the votes of a professor when they are going to elections of deans and those things. So, yes, that's very progressive. So, those were the most interesting proposals that I found these days, trying to, you know, take from the proposal the most interesting things. What I want to tell you is that even though the proposal was not approved in referendum in 2007, the government has tried to push those issues using laws. You know what I mean? A lot of people in the opposition in Venezuela that say that is unconstitutional, because for that was the referendum in 2007. But they don't say that in 2007 they were saying to the media that the reform was not necessary because the government can do that by law. You know what I mean? So that's what the government has been trying to do. The government has been trying to do, by law, some of the changes contained in the proposal of 2007. Those changes that the Constitution allow. So here what I prepare is like a summary of the recent nationalizations in Venezuela. So you can see there, you can see that we start in February 2007, the nationalization process in Venezuela. We start with Cantebe, which is the biggest, it was like 10 or 50 years ago, 15 years ago, the only telecommunication company in Venezuela, and it was a government-controlled company that was privatized during the 90s. And now the state take control of it, and most of the shares were from Verizon. So in February also 2007, we take control of Electricidad de Caracas, which is the biggest private company in Venezuela that was also, in this case, it was a Venezuela private company that was sold to AES, which is a US corporation. And also during the 90s. So we took control of that company also. Also Electrica Seneca, that is also an electricity company, in February 2007. Orinoco Bells Forest Corporations, we take control of them in May 2007, and that was a very strong fight that we had, because the companies that operate there before were the most important oil companies in the world. We managed to avoid conflict with them But in the case of Exxon and Conoco, they went to arbitration, and we also win those arbitration processes. Even though they went, because basically they went to arbitration without the necessity of going to arbitration because the government was, you know, trying to negotiate with them. In April 2009, we took control of Ternium Sidor. That is an iron, one of the most important iron companies in Venezuela. Siderúrgicas is in Spanish. I don't know the translation for that in English. But it's the biggest iron company in Venezuela and in South America. And that also generated a lot of tension with Argentina, which is like has been a close ally of the Venezuelan government recently. In June 2007, we take control of the most important companies in the cement industry in Venezuela, and that affects Cemex, Cementos Mexicanos, which is one of the most important cement, is that the word in English? Cement companies in the world, Ozin and Lafarge, which are also, were affected by, we're in control of those companies that we nationalized. We take control of, in June 2008, the president announced the process of buying the Banco de Venezuela. That was not necessary, something that was generated from the government. The news says that it was the Grupo Santander, which is a Spanish group, banking group, that wanted to sell the bank because of the crisis that they already saw in the global financial. The government finally this year approved, ends the negotiation of taking control of that bank. In March 2009, we take control of two ports, very important ports, the ports of Maracaibo and Puerto Cabello. Of course, that was in the middle also of a political battle that we had inside Venezuela, but the government were putting pressure into those ports, were in control of opposition governors, and by law, those ports should be transferred to the central government, and they resist to do that, and they had those ports privatized. So the government took control of them a few months ago. And also in May 2009, the president nationalized the oil service providers. That it means the, I don't know if that's the correct word in English, injectors, those who inject gas or water into the pozos, into the oil. And also those companies that transport the oil workers. So those are the most recent actions of the Venezuelan government in the issue of nationalization. I know that the most important debate around nationalization should be around who is going to be take control, who is going to run those companies that has been nationalized. That's a debate also inside the government, because a lot of people inside the government believe that those companies shouldn't allow the Venezuelan government to become a new Soviet Union or something like that. In terms of, you know, having the control having the control of some companies. And we want to go forward, and we want to allow the communities, allow the workers to have control of that. And we have good news around that, because a few weeks ago, President Chavez, while nationalizing the, finalizing the negotiations around Ternium Sudor, announced the idea of allowing the workers to co-manage the company. So that's what we want to see as government officials and also as progressive and socialist people in Venezuela. So those were the most important things in terms of nationalization that we have been, you know, having in Venezuela in recent years. And here I just bring some photos with, those are the Barrio Adentro models. Maybe some of you know about those things, but they are, Barrio Adentro is the social program that with the help of Cubans, we initiate all over the country to facilitate primary healthcare to poor shanty towns. So these are like the houses that the government built to in the first floor is the, I believe, is the office, and the Cuban or Venezuelan doctor lives in the upper floor. So they are in very poor shanty towns in Caracas and other countries. Of, it is all over the country, especially in poor neighborhoods. This is another of those models. This is the second level of the social health system that the government has been trying to rebuild. We call them CDIs, Centros Integrales de Diagnóstico, Integral Diagnostic Centers, maybe. And that goes to the second level of the health system. We have been building a lot of those things. And we have to recognize in the, that in the third level, we have a lack of action. We have to, the government has been planning to approach the cell the third level of the health system, which are the big hospital and those things. Even though we have been building hospitals like this one, which is the Child Cardio Hospital, Latin American Cardio Hospital in Caracas, which is the biggest of its kind in Latin America. This is it. We have been building a lot of stadiums or are remodeling them. We launched our first satellite with the help of the Chinese also a few months ago, and that is important to mention that we were negotiating also with French and British the launching of that satellite, and they don't allow us to the technology transfer, and the Chinese were the only that allowed to transfer us the technology. So right now we are building our second satellite in Venezuela, because we sent like 300 people to, when we initiated that, that was like 5 or 6 years ago, to study in China. And they are right now in Venezuela building the second satellite that is planning to be launched in 2013. So that's part of what we have been trying to do. Those are the stations in Venezuela that monitor the satellite. We have been building a lot of infrastructure. This is the second bridge over the Orinoco River. This is the third bridge that was announced a few months ago. I saw that it was going slow, but then I saw these photos that show me somehow that the project is going fast. We have been building, opening like 3 or 4 metro systems in the most important cities of Venezuela, like Los Teques, Valencia, Maracaibo. This is the metro of Maracaibo, which is the second most important city in Venezuela. This is the metro of Valencia. Sorry. This is the metro of Valencia also. We have been trying and working hard in building a railway system, and this is the first step of that railway system that connects Caracas to Cuba, which is like a suburb of Caracas. And we are planning and building new lines to that railway system, and those projects are running fine and running okay. We have been building also a lot of highways. Even though we have to recognize that even before Chavez, we had, at least in comparison with other Latino countries, an important highway system. This is a new bridge, new highways. We relaunch our national airline. I have to mention that we had a national airline named Viasa that was privatized also during the 90s and was bought by Iberia from Spain. And after a few months, they closed the company. They sell everything. They, como se dice, descuartizar. Dismember the whole thing and sell it by pieces. So the government retake the idea of Viasa and create a new airline named Conviasa, and we're trying to rebuild a national airline. We have the trolleybus, centers for ICE. There's the international airport in Caracas that was remodeled. We have been buying some Sukhois, and a lot of people criticize that, but they don't see that the U.S. government has been blocking a lot of the provisions that we had in terms of security for our army. So we have to find new ways to get provider for the security of the country. Hydroelectrical systems, trains. So those are the most beautiful pictures that I found around. Of course, we have also not so beautiful pictures, and we recognize that we still have a lot of problems in Venezuela. I don't want to lie to you, but we are trying to work hard to especially orientate the action of the government to solve the problems of the majority of the people, which are the poorest. So that's it.
I really want to thank Jesus for telling us about what is happening in Venezuela today. Before we start our discussion, we're also going to have some brief remarks from Lee Suster, who is the labor editor of Socialist Worker and also a frequent contributor to the International Socialist Review, for example, in this article on the battle for Venezuela's future. So here's Lee.
Thanks. I just want to start passing on some fraternal greetings from Gonzalo Gomez, who's a comrade from the Morea Current in the PSUV in Venezuela. Gonzalo had hoped to be with us today, but things in Venezuela are hopping as usual, and he wasn't able to pull away from some of the responsibilities that he's taken on there. He's become he's a leading figure in the independent media movement there, as well as a representative. A delegate within the PSUV in his region, and he says he wishes he could be here and hopes to be back next year. I just want to say a few things about the origins of the revolutionary process, since Jesus wasn't able to talk about that. Venezuela, according to one quite mainstream source, suffered the most in any country in Latin America during the big turn to neoliberalism, Washington consensus, privatization, deregulation, flexible labor, i.e. restructuring, layoffs, and so forth. And depending on whose statistics you believe, by 1999, 40, 50, or 60, or 70% of the population was officially under the poverty line. That's quite extraordinary. And that really is the background to everything that's been described here. And that's the context for understanding the kinds of reforms and economic advances that Jesus has been talking about. In 1989, there was a rebellion, when subsidies were cut, bus fares went up, and so on. In 89, it was suppressed brutally. No one still to this day knows how many people were killed, probably in the hundreds, killed by the army. That traumatized the army. A national section that had been organizing for years around Chavez reemerged. Tried to organize a coup on a popular basis in 92, were defeated. Chavez became even a leading figure in Venezuelan politics, and a two-time president said Chavez is not seen as a power-hungry militarist. He's seen as a popular man of the people, and he was released in prison not long after, put together an electoral movement with elements from the military, the traditional left, and popular movements, and was able to win. And initially it was quite tough going, because his victory coincided with a deep collapse in oil prices, a deep economic crisis, and Chavez's opponents, which included virtually the entirety of the Venezuelan ruling class and certainly Washington, which sees, you know, Venezuela is smack in the middle of, you know, what they consider to be their backyard, under the Bush administration, did everything possible to overthrow him, including the backing and briefly recognizing the coup government of 2002, April 2002. The AFL-CIA, the labor State Department funded foreign policy arm, was deeply involved in giving it a left-wing cover, aiding the old corrupt Trade Union Federation in Venezuela. But of course, a mass rebellion defeated that coup, and really reshaped Venezuelan politics radically. In a sense, the disconnection between the uprising of 89 and the coup attempt of 92 kind of came together in 2002 around the popular mobilization that forced the coup makers to abandon their aim. If anybody wants to see, well, what would happen if Chavez were replaced by these right wingers? Their plan called for abolishing the national legislature and would have certainly meant the massacre of thousands of militants, a massive Chile 1973 type bloodbath. That's basically what they had in mind, and they were defeated. They tried again through the control of the state oil company to shut down the economy with what was called a strike. It was really a boss's lockout, but that lockout was broken by oil workers, soldiers, and working people who over six agonizing months basically kept the basics of the economy going. They were down to one refinery that could refine gasoline in the entire country, but they were able to keep that going. And I think in that scene, in that scenario, the working class, which has been somewhat standoffish of Chavez, seeing him as basically being the sort of patron of the poor and populace, I think decisively moved over into the Chavista camp. One consequence of that, I'll talk about more in a minute, was the formation of a new left-wing union federation, the UNT. The economy, basically the right attack was blunted by the turn in the world economy and the rise in oil prices. Between the fourth quarter of 2003 and the fourth quarter of 2008, Venezuela's gross domestic product expanded 94.7%. That's pretty extraordinary, right? I mean, China was, of course, growing fast. It was faster, but Venezuela, in terms of its economic growth, wasn't far behind in that period. And as a result, Chavez was able to follow through on a lot of his promises in that period. There's too many social programs to mention. They concern health care, education, affirmative action, land reform, a whole number of things, which really transformed people's lives, cut poverty dramatically. You know, kids who would fall asleep in class because they didn't have enough to eat in the day suddenly would have a breakfast. Black people who didn't have any access to higher education suddenly were able to get access to literacy programs, learn to read. It was a tremendous shift. 2005, Chavez declares this to be a socialist turn at the World Social Forum, and there's a process of consolidation, I would say, that he attempts to in that period. In 2007, as Jesus mentioned, a constitutional reform was put forward that combined a deepening of social reforms with measures that would consolidate the power of the presidency as well. On the one hand, it was a decentralization. It was an attempt in a way to kind of pull the state apart in the sense that this corrupt middle-layer local officials, who are often dominated by the opposition, would have their power undercut from below by the expansion of communal councils and grassroots types of new formations. And at the other end of the spectrum, the presidential power was going to get stronger, and particularly in control in aspects of the military. And that was defeated because a lot of people say it was rushed. It was a rush job. We didn't understand it. And there was a kind of the right wing didn't seem to be a threat. There's a mass abstention on the Chavista side. And it was actually, it was actually defeated. And I was in Venezuela shortly before that, and a so-called student movement, a kind of U.S. manufactured. I mean, it was a genuine movement of middle-class students, but it was certainly backed and orchestrated by the U.S. They were prepared. They expected to lose the referendum, and they were expected. They had planned to occupy the central squares of Venezuela and basically dare the government to crack down on them. It was the idea of a kind of an Eastern, some of these branded revolutions that the U.S. government has orchestrated in places where they tried to carry out a regime change. That didn't happen, but it's led to a period of the last couple of years of debate within Venezuela about how is the revolution going to go forward, how's the process going to deepen, and one way to look at this is through the lens of the workers' movement. As I mentioned, the UNT, the Independent Labor Formation, came together. Unfortunately, it's been fragmented ever since. It had a couple of conferences that ended badly, and really the whole question is how to There are a number of different political tendencies that people come out of, from Christian Democrat to revolutionary left. But the basic arguments are, first of all, how do you relate to the government, but also how do you organize on the basis of what have been highly localized kind of enterprise by enterprise types of unions into sort of a more national coherent labor force. But they have been fighting. I mean, the different unions, and there is a loose cooperation among them, and they have been fighting and struggling. It was only because of several years of working of organization in the CEDOR workplace that included repression at one point by police and beating of workers, burning of cars, and so on, that led to the nationalization of CEDOR. And Chavez, you know, against over the heads of a conservative government and this Argentine management of the enterprise. And Chavez had resisted nationalization of that plant because of the ties to Argentina, not wanting to upset international relations. But the organization of the working class forced that to happen. And in not in every case that Jesus mentioned, but in several of the cases he mentioned, it was that pressure from below that forced the government to move forward. And I think that that's basically, I don't want to go on too long because I think we should open up for questions. But basically, that's, I think we have to understand Chavez and why we in the ISO have an approach of basically critical support. Chavez has been the movement. You have to understand it's concentrated around one individual. That's a problem in and of itself. But it's Chavez is trying to balance between a capitalist class which is implacably hostile to him, will do anything it can to overthrow him, and on the one hand, a working class which sees Chavez as a representative that they can push forward. And there's huge debates. You know, we want revolution within the revolution. We want to clean up the revolution. Those are common phrases. We want a socialism, the Spanish acronym they came up with was PABUCO, without bosses, bureaucrats, and corrupt people. And, you know, to have this kind of lively, intense debate within the movement itself, criticizing Chavez directly at times, and what's remarkable is that how often Chavez himself will say, well, you need to make me do things, or he'll call forth for criticism or respond to pressure in a certain kind of way. Not always, but at times. And really what it comes down to really is not what he's going to do, but what are the balance of forces. Because the problem is a comrade in this organization called the Association of Bolivarian Socialist Economists said to me, he said, look, our problem is we're trying to build socialism with a bourgeois state, and it can't be done. And so the question is, well, how are you going to do that? Now, Chavez's idea is that the state will be transformed through these series of transformations through communal councils and so forth, while trying to find the most loyal elements around the armed forces to guarantee that process against capitalist counter-revolution. And he uses that state to knock out enemies, force the opposition leader into exile, arrest a former ally turned oppositionist, military, shake up the military, and so on. And I think the lessons historically in Latin America is that process is cannot succeed. In fact, can pave the way for reaction. That's what Allende tried to ride the same balance indefinitely and ultimately led to his downfall. So really, I think the future of the Venezuelan revolutionary process depends crucially on the independent organization of the working class and its ability to fight and deepen revolutionary change. Comrades in the Morea Socialista group are inside the PSUV because they believe that that's a place there can be an accumulation of forces, but they believe that they're going to have showdown with more bureaucratic elements, employers who have managed to enter into that process as well, and that's an ongoing process. The Venezuela enters into this recession in fairly decent shape in terms of the resources at hand from the oil years and so on, but it's obviously going to have a huge impact. And the main impact it's going to be is that a confrontation between labor and capital, which has been mainly postponed, and I mean mainly, there are assassins hired by bosses from Colombia who have killed a number of trade union activists. I'm not saying, well, see, the confrontation has been postponed. I mean, at a massive level, but this is a very intense struggle going on. Also in the countryside, I haven't had a chance to talk about that in terms of land reform and violent reaction against that. But basically, because of the oil revenue, the Venezuelan government has been able to kind of bypass a confrontation with the bourgeoisie, give aid to workers and promote workers' organizations at time, but not but actually not. We haven't yet seen this kind of all-out confrontation between labor and capital. And I think that's the tendencies in that direction are great, both in the political field as well as in the economic field and in the class struggle. And I think the months in the next couple of years ahead will be very critical to depend on which way the balance of forces go. And I think it's important that we have Jesus here to come and give a straightforward presentation about what's taking place in Venezuela, and he's invited us to engage in critical debate, and we should do that. But I think what we can be clear about is that we're absolutely in solidarity with any of the Venezuelan people against any attempt by the United States government to intervene in or and overthrow the Venezuelan government, any attempt to try to promote At the same time, we don't hesitate to criticize Chavez for you know, his real politic, like congratulating Ahmadinejad for a false election, or his willingness to threaten the workers at Sador who have nationalized. He said, "Well, your state ownership, you're under state ownership now. You shouldn't strike." Well, that's exactly what Allende did to mobilize the working class to pave the way for the right wing, and we're absolutely critical, as our comrades in Venezuela, of that. So it's an open open political situation. We don't say, "Well, you know, Chavez, it's doomed to become a." It's doomed to pave the way for a capitalist restoration and so forth. The revolutionary process is foreclosed. Nor do we just simply stand back and celebrate the triumphs. It's very much in the balance. It really all depends on the capacity of the Venezuelan working class to mobilize and fight, and our ability in the rest of the world to mobilize support for them.
Wonderful. So we want to open up the floor for discussion and questions, both about, you know, some of the details of what's happening in Venezuela today, and also, you know, how we as socialists and radicals in the United States should approach this. I'm going to ask people to raise their hands. I'm going to keep a list of who wants to speak, since I'm presuming there will be many questions and a lot of people who want to speak. I'd ask everyone to keep their comments short. And the speakers will come in probably periodically to answer some questions. People should feel free to take up each other's as well. So I'm going to start with the man in the back, and please keep your hands up until I acknowledge you. But go ahead.
Three questions. One, does Chavez's government plan to bail out the banks and nationalize them? Two, can you give a little more details about health system in Venezuela? We've been talking about national health insurance here. And three, when do Venezuelans get their pensions? Do they have to wait until they're 70 to get Social Security, or is it some other age?
So probably take a few questions. Okay, so I've got the man here in the second row.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
John Riddell. I'm from Toronto. I'm a member of an organization called the Venezuela We Are With You Coalition. And I'd just like them answering the second question of the chair to say a couple things that they do. We have representatives from all the main socialist tendencies in Toronto participating in the committee. We do a lot of things that are the meat and potatoes of solidarity committees, like encouraging people to go to Venezuela, spreading information about Venezuela, working closely with the Venezuelan consulate, sending out speakers, and also reacting to the attempts of the Canadian government to undercut the Venezuelan government, because Canada, I'm sorry to say, is in this as well. But we have found that Venezuelan solidarity is a little different because of the character of the Venezuelan process, and that's what I want to say to you about. For one thing, the main attack on Venezuela over the last year and a half has not been in Venezuela, but in the Venezuelan allies, like on the Palestinian people and especially on Bolivia. And so we tried to respond to that. For example, we actually managed to set up a separate committee of solidarity with Bolivia so we can mobilize efforts to defend Bolivia against the US-sponsored coup that took shape last summer. But this went very, very well. You know, we also sent a team down to Bolivia. They did a film, they brought it back, they've been showing it. Interesting that film has been shown now in two native territories near Toronto. Because, of course, Bolivia is indigenous-led, and that means that if you defend Bolivia, you're working together with indigenous people in Canada on that question. We need that contact very badly. That's very important to us. That's in the Venezuelan spirit, because the Venezuelans say that their socialism is indigenous socialism, as well as some other things, and that the indigenous people are a leading force in Bolivia typifies that. So in this way, we were able to defend Venezuela, by getting involved in the broader process of indigenous defense and uprising across what they call Adyala, the Western Hemisphere. Well, another thing is Palestine. Venezuela, as you know, has been very strong in solidarity with the Palestinians and has sent the Israeli embassy packing, together with Bolivia, by the way, talking about boycott and sanctions against Palestine. They do it on the governmental level. So as a solidarity committee, we have to do that too. So we support the coalition against Israeli apartheid control. And when they had big demonstrations in defense of Gaza, We were always there with our banner, with Palestinian colors saying Venezuela in defense of Palestine. And this is a way to defend Palestine, to defend Venezuela, because it's a way to win support among the masses of Canadian people that are our friends in Palestine. I just say one other thing. 21st century socialism enables us to talk about all the issues posed before socialism that are also posed in Venezuela. For example, they're nationalizing and talking about workers' control. So are workers in Canada. But we can have a forum on that that includes Venezuelan point of view, but also the point of view of Canadian labor, and bring these forces together. We just recently did that on farming and food sovereignty. And critical support is not a problem. The Venezuelans are very critical. So those of us who come at this from the point of view as he does, from critical support, fit right into this environment, and the criticisms as well as the support are welcome.
Thanks very much. I forgot to say that because there's already a large list of people who want to speak, after you've been speaking for a couple of minutes, I'm going to tap, and that means start to wrap up your remarks. I'll also start calling speakers two at a time now that we've got a big list. So I've got the man here in the blue sweater, followed by the man, Zach.
Hi, my name is Mark. I'm a supporter of the League for Revolutionary Party. As revolutionary socialists, we stand in solidarity with the people of Venezuela against U.S. imperialism and its many provocations. There's no question that gains and advances have been made in Venezuela in the last years due to the massive struggles of the working class and to the rising prices of oil that benefit the economy. However, it must be said clearly, Chavez is not a socialist. Venezuela is not a socialist country, nor is it heading in the direction of socialism. As evidenced by, for example, strikes by oil workers, Sanitarios Maracay workers, Sador workers, Mitsubishi workers, all of which have been attacked by the police and the National Guard. Those are government forces attacking the strikers. That's not socialism. The only way for socialism to happen in Venezuela, as in any other country, is for the working class to take power into its own hands. And for that happening, that has not happened yet. The ISO claims to be independent from Chavez and its government, but support the PSUV. Your comrades in Venezuela evidently are in the PSUV. It is a party which Chavez explicitly demanded as a condition of joining that working class organizations, the unions, had to renounce their autonomy in order to join the PSUV. This is not a workers' party. This is not a party that communists might enter as a principal tactic to try to win people away, nor a party to which you would tender critical support. One thing you said, Lee, absolutely right. Yeah, Chavez stands between the ruling class and the working class. That's exactly right. He is, in fact, a Bonapartist. History shows what happens with Bonapartists. In the absence of a workers' revolution, Bonapartism degenerates into worse.
Okay, so I've got the man here and then here in the corner.
A few years ago, Chavez proposed the formation of the PSUV, the Unified Socialist Party of Venezuela, because there was something like, over a dozen different parties that were endorsing him in presidential elections, and he called for this new unified party, right? So on the revolutionary left in Venezuela, it was a big debate to enter this party and try to influence it, or to sort of remain outside of it as a critical left force. And you know, I think what you've been following this for the last few years, it's been clear that there's good comrades who chose to go in and good comrades who chose to stay outside, and there were clearly dangers. But the danger of going in was to be co-opted, the danger of staying out was to be isolated and to be proven irrelevant ultimately. And so it's I haven't been following as closely the past year as I have maybe in the past this development, so I want to ask a question for Lee in terms of having been in communication with Gonzalo and others recently, like basically how's that going? Because I know like last year there was some questionable expulsions. It didn't involve comrades from Marea or the sort of revolutionary left, but there were some kind of shenanigans within the PSUV, it seemed, and there were some questionable expulsions. I know it was sort of that was going to be perhaps remedied. I'm not sure if it was, but I really want to know how has the Marea Socialista tendency? Have they been making ground in the PSUV? Apparently, Gonzalo is a delegate, so that clearly shows some progress. How are things going otherwise in terms of the struggle inside of the PSUV? I guess that's basically my question.
Okay. After the man here in the corner, I've got here in the black shirt.
Yeah, my name's Dan Labatz. I'm a member of Solidarity of Fraternal Relations together. So I'm here to, the question I wanted to ask was partly the question the fellow just asked about the relationship. See, I mean, to put this a little in context, though, one of the historic problems in Latin America has been in situations of radical development, the consolidations of what we call corporatist states, where you get a government that the government from above creates a party and the party takes over the unions and so on. I'm not saying that's what's happening in Venezuela, but that is certainly a historic problem. And so I think it'd be interesting to expand a little more on this question, as you asked, about what's actually concretely taking place in the relations of the party. But also if you could talk a little bit about the dynamics. And a while back, it's like there were three different tendencies in the unions, you might say, the Secretaría de Unite, and then a bunch of kind of independents. And how do you see those dynamics? Where is that at, and how healthy does the UNT seem, and the relation of the UNT to the
great. After the black shirt, I've got the yellow shirt.
Yeah, my name is Roberto from the Rochester branch. I think it was, we have to applaud the fact that Chavez put Manuel Rosales on the run, because, keeping him on the run is keeping the ruling class violent, for now anyway. But even though that happened, you can see Chavez couldn't even come to El Salvador to inaugurate a new Fernando Martí, new president, because they discovered a plot to assassinate him. So the problem with trying to do the project that Chavez is trying to do is the same problem that what Allende is trying to do. Develop socialism within the ruling class inside the process. For as long as the ruling class is there with the wealth, they're going to buy generals, they're going to buy soldiers. Once the process become weak and this oil going down, the going down of the oil prices is going to weaken the governments, and the ruling class is still with all the billions and billions of dollars from their privileges, they're going to buy generals and they're going to buy soldiers and they're going to come and eventually overrun a process like this. So I think the nationalizations are important. Take away the privileges and the wealth, little by little, of the ruling class. Otherwise, the revolutionary thing is going to fail. When they could regroup the ruling class like they did in Chile, they'll come and do a bloody coup. So I applaud the nationalization. I was in Venezuela in 1992 with the CLAP. I was in a seminar there. And I was able to see what the ranchitos were about, the poverty in the ranchito. I was there, I think it was Hurricane Hugo, and people was out in the streets, and I was able to see what was the poverty situation in Venezuela. With the pictures we saw, you have a bank the whole lot in a few years. But if that process is to be sustained, the Venezuelan process has to continue the nationalization and take away the wealth of the ruling class.
Okay, after the yellow shirt, I've got the Democracy Now! Hat.
All right, Ben from Madison. I guess I have a couple of questions. One about the nationalization, because I kind of understand that there's a couple different approaches to it, that sort of legal, you mentioned like the purchasing of the bank, versus sort of takeovers by the state or by workers. I guess I'm trying to understand why there's so many different approaches. I'd like to understand more about what exactly is social-led production and co-ops, how that fits into what is being pursued. And these co-ops operate as sort of networks that's independent from sort of capitalist production in Venezuela, or are they competing with other industries there that are so privately owned? The thing about Chile, I see a lot of similarities, you talk about nationalization, worker action, some of which are supported, some which aren't by the government. The hostile capitalist class is still there. And that with Chile, when the confrontation happened, people weren't ready. There was a great deal of protests and giant strike actions and takeovers of stuff, but they weren't well organized enough in a way to actually pursue what exactly is happening in Venezuela now with sort of with the co-ops, with the unions, and with revolutionary organizations that is building that sort of organizational structure that could take that up, that could actually fight for working class control of the economy when the government itself may not be doing enough, as was the case with Chile as well.
Thanks. So after the Democracy Now! Shirt, I have the woman right here.
Hi, I'm Brian from What's Lafayette. I just had a question for both speakers, if I don't know. I was curious if you had any sense of what the university environment is like down there. Specifically, here in the U.S., we've seen, especially after neoliberalism, a lot of the, with the exception, obviously, of several people here, a lot of the faculty tends to adopt the stance of apologists for the U.S. foreign policy, for power, for oppression, and so forth. What I was curious is, in an environment such as Venezuela, where you have some of this conflict, is that conflict being reflected in the university environment, or is one sort of leaning over the other? And what do you see that in terms of the long-term effects of that being? So are we seeing a transition towards more equality and socialism, or is it still uphill battle?
So after this woman, I've got the man here in the hat on the side. Yeah, you.
I think that the imperialists have learned from the Cuban experience, where the bourgeoisie met en masse and allowed the Cuban Revolution to consolidate and to nationalize without compensation. I think, on the other hand, you see Venezuela and Bolivia and other countries who are thinking in that direction with a plate with their own bourgeoisie who are staying in their countries who are back to the hilt by imperialism and by, of course, the U.S. government. And so that's the thing that I wanted to point out, that what's happening in Venezuela and Bolivia right now is not that, I don't think there's a Napoleon this, you know, issue there. I think it's a question of whether it is possible to rally the whole working class and the peasants and the rest of the allies to win a revolution against imperialism, because that's who is inside, who's representing the bourgeoisie inside those countries. Thank you.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to call attention to something I've been noticing in many of the panels, where when we talk about critical support, I feel the importance of that is for us to understand historically the process we're witnessing. The comrade here expresses solidarity with the Venezuelan people, but then he concluded that that is not socialism and the Chavez is not a socialist. Like, to me, it's hard to talk about solidarity when you're telling Venezuelans you don't have the right to define what socialism means. And I'm not going to talk to you because you think Chavez is a socialist and I don't. When we talk about solidarity, and I want to praise the job of the conference over there that talked very much of the importance of not only defending Venezuela, but seeing this struggle as an international struggle, that we Latin American, the tradition that we Latin American inherited from the Cuban Revolution, from all its problems that it had. And so I would urge the comrades that I've heard refer in very critical terms, particularly to the Cuban Revolution, to just at least recognize the historical right of Latin Americans to believe that we can build a socialism that is indigenous, that can break the paradigms that maybe Marx didn't quite pinpoint on his books. But we are building that tradition and we can enrich that tradition. Venezuelans can, I think many of the comrades that work in solidarity have understood that. And all of this, maybe also to answer the question of the comrade here with the Have Democracy Now!, you were talking about university. I had the opportunity to do research in Venezuela. And what was most surprising to me was subsidized government bookstores that had all this great literature, like the Haymarket books, but you know, are $1, not a penny. I think that is to prove that when we talk, you know, I ended with that, this is the danger of that, on all these historical experiences, yeah, we need to learn that, but let's remember that Venezuelans are discussing that. Venezuelans have the most amazing collection of works on Allende that I have been, so I see the similarities too, but, and we have to be critical, but we also need to acknowledge that those debates, Venezuelans are having them, and they have the right, and we have to thank them for bringing back the war socialism to a level that we didn't see it.
Everybody know I'm unfortunately not going to be able to call on everybody that raised their hand. In part, we had the technical difficulties, but mostly I do want to make sure that we have time for these questions to be answered. So I'm just going to call on a couple of more people. I've got here in the plaid shirt, and then behind him in the white shirt. Yes.
Let's see. Try to keep this short. I actually share similar concerns too. I didn't catch your name, but Leaf for the Revolutionary
Party. Mark,
I'm right over here. About the party, but also some differing concerns. And first of all, on the question of autonomy, this is not the perfect historical parallel. But you know, I'm reminded of the Jewish labor movement and the Bolshevik Party. Not that the Kisuv is the Bolshevik Party and whatever, but just that the question of autonomy, I don't think is the central question of the party. What my concern for the PSUV is the influence of this sort of very obviously opportunistic sort of bureaucratic tendencies within the party that I think rightfully, you know, valiant revolutionary working class, you know, comrades are struggling against within that party. But their influence, especially in relation to the recent kind of cozying up to the Chinese Communist Party as sort of a model, particularly the president and sort of the Chavez has mentioned the Chinese communist system as something worth looking at and I was emulating, and even the word communist in that sense, like, makes my heart hurt a little bit. So my question, maybe to everybody, but specifically to Commander from the Venezuelan consulate, is what exactly, how do we define the relationship between Venezuela and China? And is it the same as one in Argentina, just between two nations? Or are we looking at something in the sense of being on a really unpleasant ideological term? By the way, I'm Jason from the Netherlands.
I'm Victor from the New Angel Bridge Board. Sort of have maybe a naive just comment to make, and you know, while I'm sure that you could spend hours talking about the criticism of the state and you know, how the Marxist theory ties into that, I had the good fortune of having friends from Gainesville make a delegation to Venezuela. Year and a half ago to look at the soybean and seed oil programs and sort of see what was going. And they brought me back a copy of the Venezuelan Constitution. And if you haven't read it, I just wanted to recommend that everybody take a look at that document because it's by far one of the most beautiful documents I've ever read. And you should be very proud to have that document as your governing words. And I think it's something that we can all sort of aspire to, you know, whether or not the state is carrying out the principles laid out in that document, you know, that can be discussed and debated ad nauseum. But I just think as an ideal, and it sort of piggybacks off what the comrade that had over there says, you know, if the people of Venezuela have been able to come up with this and have been able to put, or trying to put this into practice at least, then I think that we need to respect and admire and analyze what they're doing because I think they're doing something right. Whether or not it's gonna get the finish line, we'll see. But that document is beautiful and everyone should.
I do want to apologize to everybody I couldn't call on. There were a fair number of you, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm glad that we're leaving time for a large number of, I think, really excellent and important questions to get addressed. So just before I hand it back to have those questions answered, I have a small number of brief announcements. There are a number of schedule changes. Please make sure to see the board by the registration table for updates on the schedule. Those interested in working on a network to defend academic freedom in universities, please meet in the lobby at the lunch break, so that means right after this session ends. A reminder, The conference has received word that two neo-Nazi groups plan to protest the conference this afternoon. The Socialism 2009 Organizing Committee has a plan in place to deal with this. This is our weekend, and we will not let a small group of racist thugs distract us from our conference. We urge all conference participants to remain focused on the conference and to refrain from any individual acts. Also, we strongly suggest that participants don't leave the hotel or go off on their own during the lunch break. The Socialism 2009 security team will let us know if we have to revise these plans. And finally, we ask smokers to use the pool area instead of right in front of the hotel. That's all. And now back to Venezuela.
You want me to go with it? Some points I'm going to ask your advice because maybe you have more information from Panella Socialista.
And you should just say whatever you want.
Okay. I'm going to try to answer the questions. I don't know if I'm to rise or... I'm gonna try to answer the question in order. The first one was about the bank control in Venezuela. It's not a bailout, actually. What happened with the acquisition of the Banco de Venezuela? It's just that... I mean, the bank system in Venezuela was almost open to the foreign investment during the 90s because of the government we had, and after a very strong bank breakdown that we had during that decade. So that's what we have right now. A lot of banks that are branches of the biggest financial groups, I mean corporates, global financial groups. That is basically what we have now. The government somehow has been recognizing that we need more bank muscle. So the idea of having control of the Banco de Venezuela sounds interesting. So I believe that was the purpose of the government. You know, taking control of a big bank that maybe can serve us to approach financing of social-led productive units in a different way. I don't know. I saw it like that, at least. So it's not actually a bailout because the financial system in Venezuela is healthy, with the information that we have. The national, somehow that is related with a question about the different approaches to nationalizations that you raised. You basically you were wondering why there are different approaches to nationalizations. It basically depends on how the companies that we want to take control are organized. That is why there should be different approaches, because you know the complexity of how the private companies are organized inside them somehow guide the government on the way you should approach. Sometimes we buy some percentage of the share of the company. There are different approaches to that. It's not only, even in those cases that I presented you there, we don't have 100% in all of the cases of the company. You know, because they are complex organizations in terms of, they are private companies, they are corporations, so we have to somehow comply with the rules that they use. So that's maybe the answer for that question. I know that you have other questions. I'm going there soon. The national health insurance in Venezuela and the national health system in Venezuela, I have to say that we inherited a free health system like most of the Latino countries have. But in most of the Latino countries, that is just the war, because most of the people goes to the private companies, those who can afford it, or the rest of the people died because the prices. So the health system that we have was terrible, was free.
We have a social security organization in Venezuela, also like in most of the countries. But what the government has been trying to do is improve what we have. We talk about the health system in Venezuela, that there was really not any health system at all in Venezuela. We only have big hospital, and that is the third level of any health system. So what the government tried to do is approach it going to the first level, which are those models, that those barrio adentro units that I show you, then going to the second, and we right now are trying to approach to the third level that we recognize we have in a approach strongly. The social security age in Venezuela, I believe that is 55 for men and 50 for women. And also they have to have between 20 and 25 years working. I'm not an expert on that, but I believe it's something around that. And the solidarity with Venezuela, I believe that that's a good proposal, because I mean the proposal of trying to connect the solidarity, Venezuelan solidarity all over the world with important international issues that are somehow related to Venezuela. I believe that might, and somehow that happened actually in the solidarity movement, but you know, having that clear maybe is going to help some people that sometimes, some people in the solidarity movement that sometimes feel like lost because they don't know how to connect. So I believe it's a good proposal. I don't know if you want to say something about that, Lee? Okay, worker class and oil. Okay, that's a good point, the worker class and oil. Venezuela and Chavez are not socialists. Attacks against workers, the Bonapartism or Chavez. I believe that all those things are important. I mean, I believe that the mere presence of you in this kind of events are important because somehow put some pressure on us. Okay, I recognize that even that criticism is important because that let us know that you are somehow monitoring those things. So, but of course I'm not agree with most of you because you are taking like things from my perspective out of context and you know, sometimes I felt like magnify them. For example, those attacks to some demonstrations, I believe that they are isolated situations that happens and happens everywhere. But when you see the whole picture on how the government approach to the organization, demonstration, and those things, you are going to see a huge difference among what we had before and what we have now. So I believe that that's important. Of course, there are some facts that you might, and we might criticize. But you have to realize that, you know, that we are not a monolithic government that everybody have to follow exactly the order. You know, there are people inside the organizations, inside the institutions, and, you know, things happen. As you same recognize, I believe, and as Lee says, I believe that Chavez is between, he's trying to mix things, he's trying to, you know, take the pressure from, not only from the military, from the economic power, from the, but he also, and I believe is the most important pressure that he received pressure from the workers, from the grassroots movement, and this is the only case that I know that we saw our government responding to the pressure of the working class and of the grassroots movements. The debate inside the PSUV, I'm not a member of the PSUV. I didn't like to be part of that, and no one criticized me for doing that. So somehow I say that because I want you to know that is not something that is, we are forced to be part of the PSUV or things like that. But I know about the debates inside the PSUV. I know about that there are a lot of contradictions inside the party, but you have to recognize that there have been a lot of achievements in terms of how we organize. We didn't have, before this party, we have something worse, which was the Polo Patriotic, or the Patriotic Poll, an organization that we only create for electoral purposes, and I believe that PSUV is something more well organized. Of course, they it has a lot of defects, but we had internal elections for the regional elections. We have been doing a lot of things, trying to improve the party. Como las tendencias, there are a lot of tendencies inside the UNT that I don't know too much, but maybe Lee can talk about that. Oil and weakness of the government, why the different nationalization approach. The COP are seen as social productive units, but somehow I know the criticism of the about the COPs, because somehow they reflect they play somehow the role that any private organization have. So there, I recognize that there are a lot of criticism around the COP movement, but we see it like as an approach and as an instrument to, you know, reach the goals of a social led productive organization, more strong than what we had before. How the popular initiatives, the question about the universities. I'm gonna answer the question about the university. The universities in Venezuela are very complex. We have private universities, we have public universities. The most important public universities somehow were controlled step by step by people from the right. Even though they are public, even though they receive a lot of funding from the government, they are against the government in most of the cases. I mean, their authorities and their students. If you do a survey, you're gonna see that most of their students are from, the rich class, and somehow doesn't reflect the interests of the government. There's a contradiction. Of course, we have a group of new universities that the government has been created, as the Bolivarian University and other universities, which somehow try to reflect what the government want to do, and somehow teach, and are aiming to form the people that we are trying to form. We have a lot of things to do about the formation and education still in Venezuela, but those things exist. And the idea of having the vote, the equalized vote that was included in the constitution proposal reform was great, because somehow we were thinking that that might somehow democratize more even those public universities that are in control of the right. So sorry for the not answering all the questions, because there's not too much time.
It's
but I can answer
fault.
Those questions later, sorry.
Yeah, we do have the lunch after this for unanswered questions.
Okay. Just a couple questions. I mean, I think that on this question of Chavez's state and nationalization, a lot of these cases, I think the Speaker of the NLRP has it wrong, a lot of these nationalizations took place from pressure from below, and then within that, you still had a struggle by the unions, particularly in the nationalized electrical company, for trying to implement workers' control, which is nominally part of what's supposed to happen, but was not being honored at all by management. And at one point, a union leader was being attacked by management for being a counter-revolutionary and so forth. So these are big ongoing struggles. And you know, when these local police attacks, that you know, there's a gap between opposition-controlled localities or governors and so forth, or right-wing Chavista, you know, opportunist Chavista types, who have been struggled against and pressured from below. So this is not a totalitarian state where like a local cop in Ciudad Guayana is responding directly to what's happened in Caracas. They're different localized relations of forces. So you can't overgeneralize those sorts of things. What you can see though is that working class resistance and political pressure has in most cases been able to push back against that and reassert workers' right to organize. I think the difficulty though is that the working class has still not been able to kind of put forward its own independent organizations in a sustained way, either economically in terms of trade unions or politically, either within or outside the PSUV. And so a recurrent, so we have again and again Chavez kind of presenting himself. It's me or the reaction. And most recently this took place with the amended constitution in November where a third term was elected. Now, you have to understand constitutional politics in Latin America. If Venezuela wants to add a third term to the constitution, it's a power grab, paving the way for a dictatorship. But if in Colombia, if it's a right-wing Uribe who's pro-US wants to do it, well, it's just, you know, the democratic will of the people. So just keep that in mind when you're discussing that question. So what Venezuela still has, of course, is the right of recall, which wouldn't that have been great to have in this country over the last 8 years? So that still exists, even though you have the right for third terms. And of course, there are plenty of European precedents and so forth for that. So I'm not too exercised about that. But I think what it symbolizes is a bigger problem, which is that the process is dependent so much around Chavez, people around him, still today, that it makes the movement that much more vulnerable to an assassination, a coup, and so forth. And that's really the challenge ahead. Because I think here that, yes, Venezuela is different, but there are parallels with Chile that really should be are very sobering. I mean, Allende, the reason why the working class was demobilized when the coup took place was because Allende demobilized them. He said, they wound down the struggle, they attacked striking workers, the cordones and loose workers' councils were demobilized. Allende was promoted as head of the armed forces because he was seen as the guardian of the non-political traditions of the Chilean military, and we know what happened after that. And that's the contradiction. You cannot resolve the clash between capital and labor by re-engineering the bourgeois state, no matter how radical reformist you may be. There's no way the military is going to be the guarantor of the revolutionary process. And Chavez, you know, and there's a big debate in Venezuelan military about Chavez's attempts to try to have mass training and mass armaments and so forth versus buying more submarines and planes and so on, which would be useless anyway against U.S. imperialism. So that's the big contradiction: is the working class going to be able to move forward? And you know, there are good questions about, you know, the ins and outs of what's going on in the PSUV and UNT. I find it from afar, having not been there in quite a while, I find it difficult to comment with any authority on that, except what I can report is what comrades say, is that inside they feel like there's room for the left, the revolutionary left in the PSUV to organize, that they deepen their support, that it's become a rallying point, the Marine Socialist Current, as well as others, have become rallying points for people who do want the process to radicalize and continue. And just to give a flavor of the formulations, in the recent issue of Marine Socialista around this, whether or not to vote for Chavez, to extend the third term, they write, this is going to be a crude translation while I'm reading it, but we have to keep Chavez in office not so that the bureaucratism and corruption and reformism that slows down and sabotages and perverts the changes continues, but in order to deepen the revolution and put forward real definitive solutions to social problems that are oppressing the people, the Chavez remaining in office can give cover to the acceleration of the transition to socialism, and of course that depends not on Chavez, but above all on our struggles, on our initiative, and the pressure of the workers together with the revolutionary people. So that's the formulation. And I think that I find it, you know, I know people and have feel comradely to people on both sides of that debate, but I'm more convinced by this perspective, that this is for the moment a way to accumulate the forces of the revolutionary left. I also think it's a very dangerous proposal, as Dan pointed out. I mean, there's plenty of other examples in Latin America where revolutionary lefts have been swallowed up by and co-opted by sort of state-fied party apparatuses historically. It's a tremendously risky operation, but as in Latin America and the rest of the world, revolutionary left has been fragmented, and in Latin America, you have fragmented revolutionary left in the face of these broader movements. How do you begin to close that gap? So that's the challenge that revolutionary socialists in Venezuela face today, and I think it's a strategic and tactical question, not a principled one, about whether to participate inside the PSUV, which is again a highly contradictory organization, and I don't believe can maintain itself in the current form in a heightened state of class struggle. But I think there'll be choices to be made in the period ahead. And I think for us, we have a problem in that the anti-imperialist, the kind of work that has been done historically in the U.S. around the struggles in El Salvador and Nicaragua haven't really happened in the same kind of way around Venezuela because of the decline of the left and the weakness of the anti-war movement. But I think that that's no reason not to do anything. I think that there are ample opportunities to kind of do the work that John Riddell was talking about in Canada. We have been participating in some of that work in the past. I think people who are interested in able in carrying out that work can provide an important act of international solidarity for a process that we do want to see deepen and transform and revolutionize in the way that the Maria comrades have laid out.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.